Sunday, 5th February, 1978. Everyone in the world has used the word mind throughout the ages. What exactly do we mean by mind? This is a question which is not at all easy to answer. It has never been answered satisfactorily. Because, in fact, there is no single answer, no precise definition, which in a pattern of words can present a concept or even a series of concepts which truly represent mind. As long as we function in the ordinary way, through the activity of our senses and the brain, what we call the thinking process is only a string of words or a succession of pictures or sounds or memories or whatever it is. And these we call mental processes, thought and feeling and so forth. Of those, we are well aware. But is there a specific organ which can be pinpointed as mind? This is precisely mind. Now, if we examine this matter very carefully, we will find that it is impossible, whilst functioning in terms of the sense functions and activities and the discursive thought process of the brain, it will always be impossible to describe mind. What I am going to say about mind is only to be taken as something suggestive regarding a profounder dimension of being and consciousness, in fact, of the creative activity, of the creative power of the universe. What I will say or try to put before you is just suggestive of that transcendent dimension which somehow or other we can sense it under certain conditions. Let us start with a very swift recapitulation of what most of you have heard, particularly at the October weekend. To start with, this entire cosmos, which includes the other word chaos not meaning disorder, but creative energy, the primordial ultimate creative energy in a state of quiescence, and cosmos emerges out of that quiescent creative energy and through motion, through activity, produces a pattern of which human beings can become aware. To a very, very limited extent, because the possibilities, the supreme possibilities lying within us human beings are all exhausted long before we can wholly touch that transcendent reality, that total reality, that which philosophers have sometimes called the absolute, the infinite, which theists call God or Godhead, which Hindu teachings have denominated as Brahman, as Atma, which the Buddha presented as the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, and so on. Now, that primordial creative energy, which is a unitary wholeness, I use a phrase like that in order that one may appreciate the all-inclusiveness of this creative energy. Remember that this creative energy represents both chaos, as I have suggested, and cosmos, that which is patterned and that which is unpatterned. Chaos as the unpatterned is the original meaning in Greek of chaos, not disorder. Out of chaos emerged cosmos. This creative energy, in the process of manifestation, because creative energy cannot be divorced from constant creative activity, not in space-time, but in eternity. Now, do realize the tremendous difference in the two contexts when we human beings talk of it. Creative energy in eternity has no such thing as laws, as restrictions, as confinement, as specific patterning, as being true to type, as growth or progress or development or fruition or fulfillment at all. If we use any of our terms, however sublime, however profound, however inclusive, they will always detract from the indescribable, immeasurable, utter supremacy of that creative energy. You see? Now, that single creative energy in the process of manifestation manifests in various outstanding forms which human beings can become aware of. There are bound to be many other forms of which human beings are unaware at present, and in actual fact can never know, because, as I said earlier, we reach the limits of our human possibilities. That creative energy, functioning through manifestation, through nature, would have to produce a superior being, superior in the sense of a being with much greater capacities for contacting the great realities of universal manifestation. The absoluteness of God, of Brahman, or transcendence, or use what term you like, is something which is totally beyond us, so totally beyond us as we are, that we are but specks of dust in this immensity. Not lost in it, because this immensity has been responsible for bringing us forth. And if the immensity has taken the trouble to produce each one of us, each single atom, each single particle of the subatomic state too, then everyone has significance and meaning in its existence, and therefore is not to be despised. Because we as human beings see it as something so small, and we as human beings see things which are so large, great galaxies and so forth. But largeness and smallness have no meaning in the context of transcendence. So you see, each single particle, each one of us, each galaxy is supremely important in itself as such, as manifesting the wonder, the marvel of this ultimate primordial creative energy. Now, this creative energy, one of its forms of manifestation is that which brings cosmos into being as an ordered pattern. The whole cosmos, including you and I. I like to call this aspect of the primordial creative energy mind. Now remember, this mind is universal, transcendent, all-inclusive. Our criteria and judgments and evaluations and measurements do not apply to it at all. We never can know that mind in the ordinary meaning of the word know. We cannot intuit it. Have no illusions. That transcendent manifestation remains transcendent, but it is perpetually active. Perpetually active. You see, the difficulties of language, I've said perpetually active, which implies time, the word perpetual. But what else can I say? We shall be defeated at every term because of the limitation imposed upon us through the use of words and concepts. But we have no alternative. We have to use them. Now that, regard that, approach that as mind. What is this body? It is a material pattern. A pattern consisting of solids, liquids, gases, so compounded that they produce a living psychophysical organism. Now, I've already used the word psychophysical. Let us leave out the psychical part just for a moment or two and concentrate our attention upon the physical part. This is material in terms of our human languages. It comes into being, it exists as material for a time, perishes, it dies. But this is the supreme, the ultimate concretization of this primordial creative energy. That other aspect of primordial creative energy, which we may call mind in this transcendental sense, interacting, interfusing with the particular physical pattern, the body, gives rise to psyche. Now, this is a convenient, I don't suggest anything more, a convenient way of differentiating between psyche and mind, in order that we may be able to become more sensitive to the transcendental aspect, mind itself, in its purity, in its absoluteness. It is a convenient way of doing it, because all our growth, our development, our fruition is a case of this mind, as the theistic scriptures have put it, the mind of God. This mind functions through us and comes to full fruition in us as, or rather, brings our humanness to full fruition. Mind in us then becomes really mature. We all know that the body reaches maturity by the time it is round about 20 years of age or so. But whose psyche becomes so utterly pure that that man can be truly called the full human being, the son of man? And the word man and mind come from the same root, the Sanskrit root man, from which the verb manyate is derived, which the dictionaries tell you means to think. It is a very poor definition, partly because of the limitation of words, and partly because the dictionary makers do not know anything about transcendental mind. It is this transcendental mind which is the creative power that by the act of minding produces the universe. Even that marvelous first chapter in Genesis is translated. The translation there is, "And God said." He didn't speak Hebrew. And God minded. This creative, primordial creative energy, in its aspect of, in its power to bring forth cosmos out of the no thing. And God minded this, that, and the other, and this, that, and the other was. Now you see where we are. What has to come to fruition and develop into perfection in us is the psyche. Our whole development, not only our religious development, but our intellectual and aesthetic and moral development, is fundamentally dependent upon the fact that the ill psyche, the sick psyche, has to be healed. This is where the great religious teachers have their place. They were doctors of the soul of man, the psyche. They healed the psyche, which means that the sick psyche, the hurt psyche, was not given a palliative, a pill, or presented with some counteractive procedure. Because that, all those are on the plane of the disease and the plane of the illness itself. That way there is only conflict and tranquilizing dope. There is no healing, whole making. Because if you are made whole, you are utterly different. You have grown, actually. Do appreciate this point, because it is a very fundamental point. So now, the psyche comes into being. Now you remember the words of the Buddha. Those of you who are keenly interested in the Buddhist presentation, the same thing comes in different forms in the other religions too. All the major religions have it. Cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. That's in a nutshell the whole teaching concerned with the factual living of the religious life. Zarathustrianism put it in this form: hu mata, hu kata, hu vrashta. The good mind, the good thought, the good word, the good deed. One of the great powers of God Himself, Ahura Mazda, in Zarathustrian teaching, is named Vahu Mano, the good mind. Good not according to our definition, but good with a goodness that is beyond our conceiving. Remember Jesus' words, "Why callest thou me good? There is only one that is good, and that is God, the indefinable and the immeasurable, not the conceivable, not to be limited by man, not God made in the image of man." See, it's like that, right? There is another way of looking at mind in its transcendence. Mind is transcendence meditating. The ultimate creative energy, Gottheit, Brahman, use any term you like, the Absolute, meditating is mind. And that is creative mind. If you or I can be in the supreme, truly meditative state, our meditative process is creative. Not merely procreative, but creative, which is very different. None of us know here and now what creation means. We know procreation biologically and culturally, our art and science and philosophy, all that is procreation. The specific difference is just this, that procreation lies within a limited context, that what is procreated is true to type. It has reference to what has already gone before, what is already known, and procreation will bring forth something true to type. See what I mean? The act of procreation by frogs will not produce Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. The cultural procreation activity of a musician or a poet or so forth will not produce a different kind of baby in the world. It's like that. Everything is true to type. And this belongs to the realm of procreation. Meaning that we are confined to repetitiousness, that what we produce is not something utterly new. The creative activity of the primordial creative power, energy, is something unthinkable, unimaginable. It is a pulse, a creative pulse of life-death. Instead of the word death, use the word which I like to use, other life, hyphenated, other life, life, other life, life, other life. Because the whole of space-time, substance, causation, everything is contained within the absolute is, which is eternal life, immortal life itself, you see. It's like that. So now, mind is transcendence meditating. You can't purify that. But in those old days, they didn't make this distinction between mind and psyche. I must accept responsibility for this sort of presentation. Admittedly, if you like, it is an arbitrary presentation. It has to be arbitrary. I'm an ordinary mortal, but is trying to suggest something which may help us in a way which will enable our sensitivities to open out and allow this transcendent mind to enter into us, through us, interfuse our whole psychophysical being and move us towards that unimaginable consummation which is the fruition of man as man. Now, so much for mind, psyche. This purification of the psyche, therefore, becomes the supreme essential in the living of the religious life. You will see how doctrines, dogmas, rituals, and particularly mere beliefs and concepts and so forth have very little place in the context of religion in its fullness, in its innermost depth. They, in fact, become almost obstructions to true religion, to the pure living of the religious life, which concerns our moment-to-moment awareness, our mode of awareness of our existence, and the consequence of that mode of awareness of all our thought and feeling, our mental states, our speech, our actions throughout our existence. So now, when we practice what we call, or rather miscall, meditation, samadhi, sangadhi, the supreme togetherness, what we are trying to do is so to function that the whole psychophysical being is restored to complete relationship with the total reality, the entire universe. It is because this sort of thing was realized in the ancient world, has been realized since then, and there are perfected holy ones now too. It is because of that that you find statements such as the statement in the Upanishads, "Aham Brahmasmi." Literally translated, it sounds as if it were an assertion of supreme egoism. I am Brahman. You could state, it could be stated as Jesus stated it when he was asked, "Are you the son of the blessed?" That's how the Hebrews put the question. They never said, "Are you the son of Yahweh?" They wouldn't use the sacred tetragrammaton. I wouldn't speak it aloud. "Are you the son of the blessed?" And he answered, "I am." And that was the supreme blasphemy. You find the same sort of ideas. The Son of Man is identical with the Son of God. The Manushya Putra is the same as the Brahma Putra. The child of this primordial creative energy, but specifically related to transcendent mind, mind-man, and creation. They all go together. So, meditation. You will see at once that the practice of meditation, the practice of contemplative prayer, the whole discipline of the life of the religious, the life of the yogi, has nothing to do with personal realization, with a personal development, with a personal gain. The moment there is the slightest awareness or consciousness of this is for me, I am growing, I am developing, I am realizing unity with God and so forth, you have completely negated truth, the transcendent truth. It is transcendence, it is the totality which is coming to fruition through you, the individual human, as the fully perfected human being. Therefore alone the Son of Man, the Son of Mind, can be equated with the Son of God, with the Brahmaputra. Do realize that. It is one of the most important starting points of the living of the religious life. There is nothing whatsoever for me. That is the complete dissolution of the whole of the me when the pattern which we call John Smith disintegrates. Physically and psychically, there is nothing whatsoever. Nothing that can remain as an identifiable entity separate from the totality. If there is any question of gain, it is totality which has gained. It is totality which has realized. But if there is any clinging to self, to this misconceived I am I consciousness, it's a terrible misconception. There is no real meaning to I am I. And we cling to it as if it were an entity, a permanent immortal entity through time and space, which are all self-contradictory terms. An identifiable entity. There is no such thing. Even the so-called chemical atoms, which were thought to be permanent throughout the universal process, are impermanent. They too disrupt, and we know not what transcendence is. Which would you have? To be separate from the uttermost truth, the uttermost reality, as a separate, miserable little I am I, or would you rather that transcendence came to glory through you, manifested through you perfect manhood, just as through the flower it manifests the perfection of that particular plant or tree or whatever it is. You see, make your choice. If you don't make the right choice, your efforts are futile. The fact is, you as you, I as a separate I, will never enter the kingdom of heaven, will never achieve nirvana. These are all paltry, miserable, egoistic and vain misconcepts produced by the sick psyche. The psyche which is afraid, the psyche which is ignorant, the psyche which clings for dear life, as it thinks, to any straw, but it clings not for dear life, but for inevitable disruption through death, when it clings that way. So, let go everything. Now, there are ways in which we can enable this deep inner sensitivity which lies in us. What I have called the receptive, responsive sensitivity, which characterizes every living person. We have a receptive, responsive sensitivity, which at its concretest level functions in terms of our senses and enables us to know and experience the outer world and also to become aware of the processes within our own bodies and the processes which the brain becomes conscious of. The brain is the concretest instrument of mind. The brain and the nervous system. A good many of you already know what we have called the earth meditation. One may practice this not as a technique to achieve an end, but to put oneself in a state of peacefulness and harmony as far as it is possible for us to do so, which will enable these transcendent energies to enter us and function freely in us and through us and affect the whole environment. So, if you are agreeable, we'll spend some time in this practice. This is something which is a little bit out of the way. I don't think you will find quite this sort of thing in any textbook as such of any religion. We use grand phrases. All life is one. All mankind is one. Intellectually, we may know that, but that merely tickles the top layer of our brain cells. It doesn't permeate our whole being as a fact to such an extent that it is an of course for us. Of course we are all one. And if it is a real of course-ness in that sense, our whole lives and our conduct and behavior and everything would be entirely different. We'd be free from aversion, from attachment, from hate, from annoyance, from impatience, from ambition, from grasping anything or everything for ourselves and so forth. They're lovely phrases. They tickle our fancy. They make us feel we are cultured, we are decent people, good people. Of course we are decent people and good people within very narrow limits. This is something we have to acknowledge. See? But have we any conception of what life in its totality is moving us towards? No. Not really. Now this sort of thing may help us to prepare the ground. We are the ground, the soil, into which the seed of transcendence has to drop and come to full flower. So this unity of the universe, this oneness, must first be felt intensely and quietly in our own selves. So we'll do something which so many hundreds of groups of people in their own ways, along different lines, try to do, to enter into a contemplative state, into a meditative state. Remember, it's not the true meditative state, because that is the state in which you are one with primordial creative energy, creating. All right, let the body be completely at ease to start with. Perfectly at ease. You may close your eyes if you like, if you find it easier. Now, being at ease means that there are no strains and stresses, only the healthy, elastic tension of the muscles of the whole organism. Then the body is functioning in a rhythmic state. Breathe easily and naturally. Let your own life rhythm quietly establish itself. Be at ease, particularly with the muscles of the around the eyes, the jaws, the neck, so that the head is finely poised upon the body. Feel at ease in the abdominal and pelvic regions. Be well aware of the muscles releasing themselves from strain, not relaxing in the floppy sense of the term, but in the elastic sense. And when the breath rhythm is established, your own individual breath rhythm, then you are in tune with the life rhythm of the world around you also. Let the psyche be as calm and peaceful as possible. You may notice that the brain is a terrible usurper here. It wants to take charge. The brain activity is an activity of disturbance. It keeps on chattering. Just observe it. Don't compel it or try to force it in any way. Be like the person who is sitting on the bank of a river, just watching the river go past. And with the psychophysical organism at peace, let your attention grow in intensity and be mindfully aware of the fact that this material body is composed of the same materials that make up the whole world. The same chemical elements, similar chemical compounds, similar chemical electrical activity, and so forth. So that the brain, remaining quiet, does really appreciate the fact of, to start with, the material unity of everything that is in the world. And if with practice this can intensify and become more wholly perceptive, you will become mindfully aware of all the interrelationships that exist between apparently separate people and creatures and objects. Apparently separate, but all in actual fact fully interrelated. Remain mindfully aware, no suppression of the senses. When that motor car passed by, one heard the sound it made and so forth. Not exclusive concentration, but inclusive awareness. Let this inclusive awareness extend to everyone in the room, so that one awakes to the fact that each person here is but another version, a slightly different version of oneself. Oneself is a slightly different version of each and everyone else. But howsoever different we may seem to be apparently, there is complete interrelationship in actual fact, to which we are not yet sensitively awake. Become mindfully aware, intensely aware of it. Try and extend this awareness as far as you can do so, with ease, with comfort. Let the psyche be comfortable. Don't strain it. Not a mere thought, which is a string of words, but a thought quickened with warm, living feeling. And then this sense of the unity of everyone and everything will experience natural growth. And as and when there is real growth, there is no falling back. When you are 10 years old, the body is thus and thus. When you are 15 years old, it is different. Basically the same pattern, but the body is different. It will never go back, it will never fall back, never regress to the state it was in when you were 10 years old. That is the great difference between the livingness of the context and a merely mechanical change in terms of size or difference. Let there be no aversion towards anyone, nor attachment, neither praising nor blaming. And now realize, let us be mindfully aware of the fact that at this moment of the day, here with us, and along our longitude of London, north degrees longitude, the time is the same from the north to the south pole. There are people doing similar things, and all the other things which belong to the hour of the day. They may be having tea, or they may be being a Sunday in church or in a temple, or they may be at a play or whatever it is. The different activities at this single moment . Let attention move round eastwards, where the time is, as we say, ahead of us. And different people are doing, thinking, feeling, speaking different things. Now, if you can be really sensitive and truly attentive, and make the full circle of the entire globe, right round the world, if we do that, we awake to the fact that everything that the 4,000 millions of the world think, feel, speak and do, everything is happening at once simultaneously. Somebody is sleeping, somebody is eating, somebody is murdering, somebody is in a sublime state, and so forth and so forth. Somebody is ill. Just try and let your heart be open to it all, without disturbance. Let the psyche be quiet. And awaken to the extraordinary fact that this single moment, this split second of the whole earth, of the whole globe, contains the equivalent of yours or my individual functioning throughout the 24 hours of each day. The moment of the earth is the day of a person, the whole day. And if you can be mindfully aware of this, truly mindfully aware, intensely attentive, without grasping anything, without attachment, aversion, praise, blame, then this unity of mankind grows into a reality instead of a merely philosophical string of words in the brain. Include all the kingdoms of nature in this. And if you feel interested in this type of practice, and you practice by yourself, extend your mindful awareness to the limits of the universe as far as you can. But be careful of one amongst several stumbling blocks. The brain will start merely repeating names. You will try to include Mercury, Venus, Mars, and all the rest of it, but they are just meaningless sounds. To be mindfully aware means that you are factually conscious, which is quite different from merely mumbling the words. Now, if you can do this effectually, this receptive, responsive sensitivity will grow. You will become more and more receptive, actually receptive, not merely in your imagination. Because what happens merely in imagination that way is quite harmful, where our egoism and vanity and so on are concerned. It increases them. So beware. And as this sensitivity grows, pure mind, this transcendental dimension, which is creative, actively creative, enters safely into your being. It does not shatter you. If anyone, through willful effort, opens the doors and windows of the soul forcibly, this creative energy entering inside will come across all kinds of obstructions, our psychical illnesses and limitations and so forth, and it will be an explosive force destroying the person. the yogi's meditation, which goes along such lines, that is to say, the right lines, enables, the pure lines, enables this transcendent energy to come and work in your whole being, transfiguring it. This is one of the great meanings of the transfiguration as applied to Moses, to Jesus, to the Buddha, to Zarathustra. There are accounts throughout the religious texts. One of the great examples presented in a very original form is the revelation of the divine form by Krishna to Arjuna. Arjuna found it difficult to stand that vision. Now you'll appreciate why his hair stood upon end, and he begged Krishna to resume his ordinary, gentle, familiar form. I have called this type of meditation the earth meditation, simply because we start off here and now with the body itself, with nature around us, with all the chemical elements and compounds composing us, because this is something where the brain will not obstruct, need not obstruct, and one need not feel obfuscated. One can be at home, in harmony with this fact. It remains with you to make what use of this you like. And if you use it this way, naturally, spontaneously, you become aware.